When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Matea, reminding you that this show cannot be made without you. If you've been thinking about becoming a Canada Land supporter, we're having a pretty great sale right now. You'll get premium ad-free feeds of all Canada Land shows, discounts on merch from our store, and exclusive bonus episodes, like a behind-the-scenes tour of the federal budget lockup, more of Boris Johnson's trip to Canada, and of course, more of us yapping about what's hot in politics right now. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to become a Canada Land supporter. So from now until the end of May, we have a special offer for our listeners. Sign up now for just $2 a month for the next 6 months. Just go to CanadaLand.com/join or click the link in your show notes to become a supporter today.
From Canada Land, this is Oppo.
Salut, c'est Justin Lingam Montréal. Et je suis contre Jen Gerson.
I don't understand what you just said. I'm Jen Gerson in Calgary, where we don't speak French, and I'm opposed to Justin Ling, who is apparently continuing his cosmopolitan tour of the modern-day Gomorrahs.
Yeah, Jen, that's our two solitudes. This week, we talk about the Liberal Party convention and ask ourselves, if you don't have internal party democracy, what do you really have?
Meanwhile, NAFTA is a shit show, but Justin has the receipts.
That's right, I'll be digging into my grab bag of access to information requests to bring you the tea on the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Is that the trade? Is tea the trade?
No, tea is like slang. It's like tea is like it's what the kids are saying these days,
Jen. What are you talking about? We're not children. Neither of us is a child anymore, Justin. Let's move on. And we hear from the man the Kremlin calls a convicted criminal, fraudster, and financial bandit, and who has pushed the West to sanction corrupt Russian officials in retaliation for the murder of his ex-lawyer.
So it's a pretty lighthearted episode, all in all.
FreshBooks is a ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software for small business owners that saves you time and gets you paid faster. It's now used by more than 10 million people worldwide. For your 30-day free trial, go to freshbooks.com/oppo and enter OPPO in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
Oppo is supported in part by HelloFresh, the meal kit service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes for everyone, from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. They source the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantity needed so there's no food waste. All delivered to your doorstep in a special insulated box for free. For 50% off your first box, visit HelloFresh.com/Oppo and enter promo code Oppo, O-P-P-O, when you subscribe.
So, Justin, apparently the Liberals held a campaign rally. Convention in Halifax last week.
Yeah, grassroots Liberals from around the country got together to make their voices heard on a variety of policy issues like drug decriminalization and sex work, only to have their leader respond by saying, I don't care, lol.
Right, because of course there is no such thing as a grassroots Liberal Party anymore. For that matter, there is no actual Liberal Party.
Yeah, so for those who haven't been following along, in Halifax over the last couple of weeks, the Liberal Party got together to discuss policy resolutions and to vote on various things that they would love to see in the party platform. And you know, I think we always think of these things as sort of back-of-the-napkin resolutions coming from a bunch of crazy socialists, but in reality, a lot of these resolutions are really thought out, they're detailed, they're researched, they're methodical, and they're actually pretty, I don't know, out there and progressive, especially for a party that styles itself as progressive. They're pretty forward thinking. Two of the big ones that got a lot of attention over the last couple of weeks was one on sex work, which read, you know, be it resolved, the Liberal Party of Canada repeal the 2014 Protection of Communities and Exploited Persons Act, which is the legislation that actually criminalizes the purchasing of sex work, and begin a consultation period where basically they talk about the legalization of sex work entirely. The other one was on drug possession. In order to fight the opioid crisis, the party members got together and started discussing a resolution that would have called on the government to reclassify low-level drug possession and consumption charges as administrative violations instead of criminal charges. In effect, the Liberal Party wanted their own government to decriminalize sex work and drug possession. And the Prime Minister came back and said, too bad, I don't really care.
Yeah, so I think we have to even go back a little bit further in time here and talk a little bit about what conventions are and what they're actually supposed to be within the democratic process as we've come to understand it over the last 100 years. So traditionally speaking...
Yeah, Gen history lesson.
So traditionally in a convention, if you've never covered them, they're actually really fun and interesting to cover, because what happens is that, you know, every single constituency has this little core of hardcore party diehards who meet and discuss all kinds of issues related to their constituency and who gets selected to run in nominations and all those sorts of things. And it's really great. And what traditionally happens is that these individual constituencies will come up with potential resolutions that then get debated at convention floor. So when you get to a convention floor, the first thing you as media get handed is this big package. It's like, well, here are all the resolutions that we're going to be debating at the convention floor today. And what a lot of media tend to do is they tend to look for the most outlandish or crazy shit and then do these big headline pieces like, the NDP wants to become a communist, wants Canada to become a communist government.
Or, of course, for the Conservative Party in the last couple of years, a lot of focus was paid on a motion that would have formally abandoned their policy on opposing gay marriage.
Yeah, exactly. So they focus on the crazy stuff. But what often gets left
That's
out
not
of that
crazy,
coverage?
But
It's exactly.
The sexy stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's sexy stuff. But what often gets left out of this coverage is the fact that almost none of those resolutions ever even make the floor. And that's because there's this really complicated backroom wrangling that decides which policy resolutions actually gets which priority. And as a result, they're really able, the party leadership is generally able to sort of wiggle down the stuff that they know is going to be controversial or untenable, and they wiggle up the stuff that they think is going to be less controversial or more fathomable for the party to deal with.
And it's certainly true that, you know, the party leadership over the last, you know, half century has gotten more involved in this whole process and been a little bit better at scripting and stage managing all of this. I recall an NDP convention a couple years ago, I think in Montreal, where there was actually a very similar resolution to the one we just talked about sex work and decriminalizing sex work, where a number of MPs took to the floor to basically run interference and make sure that never kind of came to a vote, or if it did, it was going to lose. So, you know, I think, you know, this history lesson's good because it kind of maps out how over the last number of years, parties have been sort of more skittish about this whole process.
Right, and they've essentially been centralizing more and more of it. But traditionally speaking, the party would come up with these resolutions and then this would get incorporated into a platform so that essentially the party wasn't just some centralized top-down thing that got ran out of the leader's office. Actually, there was a grassroots, and the grassroots would have a significant say in trying to shape overall party policy going into the election. But what the Liberals have done is they've just completely done away with all of that. So this is actually the first... No, they have. Now here's where I'm going to explain why they've gotten away with all of that, is because this is actually the first election where they're haven't even been delegated members. Like, this is not a delegated convention where you have a certain number of people coming from every single constituency you're riding anymore. Now it's just a goddamn free-for-all where anybody who can fly over to Halifax and sign up for the membership gets to go hang out in this convention rally. So, like, because there is no membership, any real Liberal Party membership anymore, there's no actual accountability. This isn't grassroots members coming together to help the party create and craft policy. This is a campaign rally where they debate policy that then everything is now so centralized under the leaders' office can just say, nah, we'll pass. You have no power. You have no... It isn't a party anymore. It's a brand. And I think that's fundamentally changed here.
That's not unique to the Liberal Party. I mean, no party convention matters anymore. I mean, you know, maybe the NDP is actually the most emblematic of that. The NDP used to be the party that was most dedicated to the grassroots, you know, membership, apart from maybe the Reform Party, because I think a lot of credit goes there with their direct democracy nonsense. But, you know, the NDP was kind of founded on the idea that not only local members, but local unions, local church groups, and, you know, all sorts of crazy nutjob Marxists could get together and sort of build out the party platform and set direction for the party so that, you know, the insiders wouldn't be the ones doing it. You know, the NDP was created to reject the sort of Bay Street liberals of the Liberal Party and the sort of oil tycoons of the Conservative Party. And it's so funny to me that they've gone wildly in the opposite direction. If anything, I would hazard a guess and say the NDP conventions are now the most scripted and tightly managed conventions in the country. So but, I think to lay this just as a defeat of the liberals is not totally fair.
Well, I would agree that all parties have over time drifted in this direction, but I think that the liberals have taken this further than any of the other parties. And I go back right down to like to sort of 2015 when they created the supporter class of membership where anybody could essentially just sign up to vote for Justin Trudeau. The problem with that is that when you create a supporter class of membership, when membership doesn't actually mean anything, when there's no sacrifice or requirement required of membership, it's not really membership anymore. Essentially, all it is data mining. All they're asking for
you... It's almost like voter registration.
Yeah, exactly. It's voter registration. It's data mining. They're just using you so that they can get you on an email database so that they can send you fundraising campaign emails. That's all that supporter class is doing for you. And the whole process by which a party was sort of a two-sided conversation beside the grassroots and the leadership of that party or the oligarchy within that party, I think the liberals have essentially completely abolished that.
And so, you know, let's bring this back to like, the specifics of what we're talking about, because I think this is academic for some people, but the party membership in Halifax got together and, you know, had a vigorous back and forth in like basically what is in some ways a constituents assembly, kind of the most primarily democratic thing where anybody off the street, you know, now because of this membership class can come in and debate policy that could later be hopefully policy of the governing party of Canada. And they decided that they wanted to decriminalize the sex trade, create more pension protections for workers, decriminalize low-level drug possession to fight the opioid epidemic, which is killing thousands, and, you know, numerous other things, establishing a mincom model. You know, these are big policy ideas. And
totally.
In response to that, the Prime Minister and the Liberal Party of Canada said, "Oh, thanks for your input. We'll think about it and give you a call."
Yeah, come check out our speech with David Axelrod on the main stage at 3 kind of thing.
Exactly. That is so offensive to me. I mean, you know, on most of these things, they said kind of, "We'll think about it." On drug decriminalization, they said, "No, sorry, we've already made up our minds. Tough shit." You know, that's not acceptable to me.
No, and it tells you everything you need to know that there was not even a pander there. Like, there really wasn't even a pretend to take this seriously. It was like, it's almost like they're treating this like the Model UN. Thanks for coming out, kids.
Exactly.
That is offensive.
You know, it is tough. These things are controversial, but you have some cover. I mean, we have countries in the world that have decriminalized drug possession. We have countries that have decriminalized sex work. Hell, Canada was one of them for many years, or for at least a year. But in Canada, the NDP have already come out in favor of drug decriminalization. And if the Liberal Party is good at anything, it's stealing NDP policy. So it's not that out there, guys.
I would argue we already are doing drug decriminalization to some extent. I mean, you want to see what some of the policies that are now being passed by like the CMA and doctors is that if you are dealing with someone who has a chronic opioid addiction, one of the things that they're now moving toward is giving prescription levels of certain opioids and drugs so that, you know, I mean, we're already moving in that direction. So,
and if the Canadian Medical Association can debate it, you know what? So can the Liberal Party of Canada. Track your hours, format the estimate, work out taxes, capture your expenses, chase that late payment, prepare the invoice, submit the proposal. Welcome to the worst part of being a freelancer, otherwise known as paperwork. The good news is that our friends at FreshBooks have created ridiculously easy-to-use counter-clouding software for freelancers that turns tracking these time-sucking, never-ending tasks into no big thing. Send a polished invoice in 30 seconds, set yourself up to get paid online in 2 clicks, and manage your expenses by taking pictures of receipts from your phone. Oh, and if you need to whip up a quick proposal to land the gig, FreshBooks has you covered. Now you can include an outline of your project, scope of work, and a timeline as part of your estimate. No more switching software, no more fussing over style and formatting, and most importantly, no more wasting your precious time. To find out all the ways FreshBooks will transform how you deal with your paperwork, go to freshbooks.com/oppo and enter oppo, O-P-P-O, in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
And now for a recurring segment on Oppo, Red Stream, Blue Stream.
Well, Jen, which internationally lauded environmentalist of the oil slick deplorables in your part of the country want to drag through the tar sands this week?
Why, funny you should ask. That internationally lauded environmentalist is David Suzuki, predictably. So this is actually a really fascinating story. So the University of Alberta decides to grant David Suzuki an honorary degree. And who speaks up about this first of all? Guess who the person is.
Is it Jason Kenney? I don't even want to play the...
The oil slick deplorable. No, the person who first speaks up against David Suzuki is that noted oil slick deplorable, Andrew Leach.
Oh.
Also known as literally the University of Alberta professor, economics professor, who helped the NDP craft their climate change policy. Well,
what was Andrew Leach's concern?
Andrew Leach went on quite the little Twitter tirade about Suzuki, noting that Suzuki has, for the last 30 years of his career, basically shat on economics, even though he had really no understanding about economics or how any of it works.
It's a good point.
So it is a totally fair point. So anyway, this raised the ire of a lot of people. And what got really interesting after this point is activism in Alberta is a very interesting thing to watch because it ain't protesting on the streets kind of activism. The type of activism that happens in this province is email activism. It's somebody influential who has a really wide network of wealthy and powerful people start sending chain emails. And these things start to work their way through.
this is my version of hell.
No, but then these chain emails start to like work their way through these networks. And I started to get privy to these things about just how pissed off people were about the fact that Suzuki was getting this honorary degree. And then all of a sudden you're hearing this chatter, like the dean of engineering sends this long email and basically pushing back saying like the university shouldn't have given this guy the honorary degree. The university is clearly under pressure, but I mean, like, it's not public pressure. It's very clearly private pressure from donors who are now pulling out of the university and saying, we're not going to fund you if you're going to fund this guy. University of Alberta, of course, is trying to gain international cred and reputation, and they now can't show themselves to be pushed around by small ball donors in Alberta. They have to stand by this honorary degree awarding. And in the meantime, the entire province is kind of losing its mind about this. And what's fascinating to me about the whole furor over the Suzuki honorary degree isn't necessarily the fact that it's an honorary degree granted to Suzuki. I mean, the schools here have granted honorary degrees to people like this for a really, really long time. What's fascinating about it to me is that it demonstrates just how much Alberta is cracking. Like, this is a province that has undergone several years now of a very devastating recession and oil bust. This is a province that feels, now I'm talking about feelings here, I'm talking about emotion. This is a province that feels that it keeps on getting kicked in the teeth from the rest of Canada, that it can't get a pipeline built no matter what we do. I mean, we put together this great, you know, country-leading climate change strategy policy. Nobody seems to care. You know, this is a country that consumes oil products at an enormous rate that benefits financially from what Alberta produces, and yet is absolutely happy to continue to make Alberta like the bogeyman of the petrochemical economy. And like, to me, what this controversy symbolizes is just how emotional and heated and angry people are, that they're like snapping, they're just losing it. And this is like the Suzuki thing is just like the straw that broke the camel's back. This is a dude who is coming around saying things like the energy economy is the moral equivalent to slavery, and now we're honoring him in one of our top schools institutions. Like, it's just too much. It really isn't about David Suzuki. It's about what David Suzuki has now come to represent in the mind of Albertans. And David Suzuki represents the sort of fundamental hypocrisy of the rest of Canada for a province that feels like it has been on the receiving end of a lot of bullshit for a very long time. Albertans have been having this conversation for years. And I think that like people are just fed up and fatigued with it, myself included. So can we please stop?
Can we appoint David Suzuki as official spokesperson for Trans Mountain?
Oh, totally. That's perfect.
Okay, perfect.
Problem solved. I mean, there, your problem solved, Canada. Justin and Jen, we're just...
problem solvers. That's what they call us.
Okay, so Justin, you are a low-energy blue pill popper. What's bubbling to the top of your social media feeds of outrage and woe?
Okay, so unfortunately, mine's a little bit down. You know, like many, I've been horrified by the van attack in Toronto of the past week. As I'm sure everyone is aware, a guy by the name of Alex Manassian rented a van and used it to hit as many people as possible on a busy street just north of downtown Toronto. According to a Facebook post of his motivation was to strike back at women because they didn't want to have sex with him. Now, there's obviously a long conversation to be had about a whole bunch of these different topics, and we should get into those at some point. Mental illness, terrorism, online radicalization, sexism, misogyny. Obviously, I want to hear about all of that, but for right now, I want to focus on something that I heard from numerous women who reached out to me after I wrote a piece in the Globe and Mail just this last week about the incel or involuntarily celibate community. And there's one tweet in particular that kind of stuck with me. And it's a woman who just said, you know, I got threats over an article I wrote a few years ago. She said, you know, like most women with an opinion on the internet. And it's something I heard again and again from women saying, you know, we've been talking about this for years. The online troll community is terrifying. It's violent, it's misogynistic, it's racist, it's so on. And I get some of it. You know, I'm a gay dude. I get homophobic posts, but I occasionally get a glimpse into what women get, and it scares the shit out of me. And it's dawning on me over the last couple of days that we haven't taken it seriously enough. And Jen, I can only imagine you probably get plenty of this. I don't have to be telling you about this, but it's something that struck me because, you know, a lot of the time these sort of things feel very sort of esoteric or disconnected from reality, but we now have a potential attack that killed 10 people, mostly women, done by a guy who hated women in a community of people who torment women online. And I would like to think we talked about this enough previously, but I don't think we have. Now that I'm sitting here, I'm realizing we have not addressed this fulsomely enough. And to compare the amount of time I've spent doing interviews, writing stories about online Islamic radicalism versus the amount of time I've spent sitting around talking, writing articles about online anti-women radicalization, I'm realizing it doesn't stack up. And that makes me feel pretty shitty.
I don't think you should feel super shitty. I mean, a little shitty is probably a good place for most men to feel at all times. But
fair enough.
Then you will get a sense of how women feel all the time. No, I mean, truth be told, I don't really get it as bad as I think a lot of women do. And I sort of analyze why that is. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is because I ruthlessly block and mute. I'm really quite diligent about that.
That's smart.
The other thing too is, honestly, I don't really talk about feminism a lot. And yeah. You know, I think that a lot of the really nasty stuff gets directed to women who have the audacity to suggest that women should have equal political and economic rights to men and make that sort of the one of their champion causes. And maybe I'm a bad woman or a bad feminist, but to be honest with you, I've just always really been more into the nitty-gritty of politics or pipeline issues or like those sorts of, I haven't really delved into the culture wars so much. And I think that if you kind of have a tendency to stay out of culture war issues have a tendency to stay out of you. That being said, have I been subject to harassment and threats and all that sort of stuff? Have I had to call the police on readers? Yeah, I mean, I've had to do all that. That's pretty normal for, I think, most women.
It's horrifying.
Yeah, it is horrifying. It shouldn't happen. I'm not trying to minimize it in any way. What do we talk about, though? How do we fix this? How do we, like, do you know what actually really horrified me today? No, I want to tell something that actually horrified me today. It's something that Jeet here sort of brought to, I think everybody said she was tweeting about it. So the original quote is this, is by a guy named Robin Hanson. Those with less access to sex plausibly suffer similarly to those with low income and might similarly hope to organize to lobby for redistribution along this axis. Strikingly, I see little overlap between those concerned about income and sex inequality. Sex inequality, like sex is a thing that can be distributed like money. I mean, I don't think this guy's an incel, he isn't. But the degree to which you have to not see women as people to make an argument like that is what I find disturbing, because there is no way to forcibly redistribute sex with women without having a conversation about rape, or at the very least, coercion. And
fair enough. The conversation needs to happen. We need to actually address this head on and just tackle it, which we haven't done thus far.
I don't know how to tackle it. I don't know how to tackle it.
We gotta figure it out.
I really don't. And the problem that I have here is that, like, I think most women who have a public profile, I recognize and instantly dismiss a lot of this stuff for what it is. And that is men who don't see women as people and who are lashing out at women with opinions because they are trying to, in some small way, shut them down in a bid to make room for their own spaces in their own light. And that's really all it is. And it works on a lot of women. I mean, that's the other thing that I think maybe we don't have a conversation about, is that there are women who are out there who are willing to put up with this to a certain degree. It absolutely takes an effect on you. I think it has a toll on every woman who is in the public sphere. I mean, I don't know one of us who isn't a little weird or isn't a little anxious as a result of some of this shit that happens online now, and I'm certainly one.
Yeah.
Oppo is also supported in part by HelloFresh, the meal kit service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. Each week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take around 30 minutes. This kit is meant for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. They source the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantity needed, so there's no food waste, and it's all delivered to your doorstep in a special insulated box for free. For 50% off your first box, visit HelloFresh.ca/Oppo and enter the promo code OPPO when you subscribe.
So, NAFTA. Jen, it says here you should just be endless screaming.
Yes, I literally just wrote endless screaming between
Can
two
you
asterisks.
Just scream endlessly for me.
Ah, Yes, so that enormously important deal that governs 80% of our trade with the U.S. According to Trump, that was supposed to be negotiated for the most part by the end of last year, and then by the end of March, and now April, and now in May. Justin, poor Chrystia Freeland looks like she's on the edge of death. What is taking so long with this deal?
Well, as of this taping, there actually seems to be some optimism that it's coming to the end of the tunnel. I mean, notwithstanding some random Trump tweets about I mean, every time Trump tweets about, as former Mexican President Vicente Fox puts it, that fucking wall, it seems like it's farther and farther away. But, you know, according to negotiators and people on the ground, numerous chapters have already been closed. And even the Mexicans think that a deal might be around the corner. It's closed as next month. I mean, okay, that's pretty huge.
But let's be clear. It's like 6 out of 30 chapters have been closed. So numerous, yes.
Yeah. I mean, 6 is better than 0.
Yeah, but nobody's really arguing the non-contentious stuff. I mean, look, Justin, I have a confession. I think that a NAFTA deal is not going to happen. And there's a number of reasons why I think. Yeah, I think it's not. Either it's not going to happen, or it's going to happen in the worst possible way. So the original NAFTA deal, from beginning to close, from like negotiation to, you know, legal fine-tuning to vote and ratification, took about 30 months. And we're about 7 months in. There are a bunch of political deadlines that are coming up that essentially can't be avoided and almost certainly won't be made. So the number one deadline that seems to be coming up is the fact that in order for any kind of NAFTA deal to pass Congress before the midterm elections in November, an actual deal would have to be complete by like the end of May at the absolute latest. And truth be told, there are some experts who have said already, like, it's too late. You can't reasonably get a NAFTA deal past Congress at this point.
Well, that doesn't really matter, though. I mean, any deal is going to pass Congress. Like, there's almost, I mean, most congressional votes on trade deals are up or down votes. They don't actually, they've lost a lot of power to tinker.
Yeah, yeah, but there are strict deadlines here. I can point it out directly. But there's
most congressmen and senators have very little impetus to actually mess around with NAFTA. For most members of Congress, it's pretty popular in their district. And the vast majority of both houses are actually in favor of NAFTA, thanks in no small part to an aggressive Canadian lobbying effort. And sure, that might change after the midterms, but if anything, it's only going to improve. Democrats, at least these days, tend to be more sympathetic to NAFTA than the Republicans. So I don't know that there's any concern from that end. I think as soon as Trump is willing to put his name on a document here, we're going to see that document eventually make it through Congress.
Yeah, but the question is, will it be made through Congress before the midterm election, which may completely decimate the current composition of the House and Senate? So under U.S. trade law, what needs to happen is that if you have a deal on the table, in a best case scenario, the U.S. International Trade Commission has exactly 105 days to analyze the economic impact of that deal. So there's 105 days right off the bat. In addition, there are a couple of other procedural hurdles that have hard timeframes attached to them. So if you want to get a trade deal like this passed before Congress, before the midterm election, so again, before who the fuck knows what happens, it has to essentially, there's a hard timeline. It has to be done by the latest at the end of May.
Let me posit this to you. Trump doesn't want it passed before the midterms. What Trump would want is announcing literally the day before the vote that they have a NAFTA deal. A lot of, you know, the Americans, I think probably more than any other time previously, there's some polling data that does back this up, support NAFTA. I mean, NAFTA is actually relatively popular in its you know, its adult life. And you know what? The one thing I think I've started to realize from Trump recently is that he's really enjoyed winning. I mean, you know, that's a shocker from a guy who uses that like his personal catchphrase. But, you know, after his first year in office, the Trump administration only had losses on the books. Now you see Trump walking around like he has a new lease on life because he has tax reform done. The Korea deal looks like it's going relatively well. His strikes on Syria seem relatively well tolerated. He seems like he's a man who wants wins at any cost. I do not put it past him even slightly to jettison all of his past beliefs on NAFTA for the sake of actually getting a deal done.
Yeah, but here's the thing. He didn't promise to get a deal done. He promised to just blow it up. If he were to come here and like they were to all come together with some kind of deal that he could then sell as a win to his base, okay, yeah, maybe. At this point, there's some real doubts that that deal can possibly pass Congress in time for the midterms. Fine, but maybe he doesn't need them to technically pass midterms. But the promise is still fundamentally broken, because the other problem is that even if he has a deal in principle, if it doesn't pass Congress, the next composition of the House and the Senate could be made up of people who are completely happy with NAFTA as it is, or who just want to like block Trump's agenda for the sake of it, in which case the whole thing goes into limbo indefinitely. So
imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
But
I don't see that happening at all.
But that is actually what is about to happen. If they don't have a deal, like, basically sometime between now and the next, like, three or four weeks, they won't have a deal in time for the midterm election, which means, the possibility of this thing stalling in limbo indefinitely becomes the real likelihood, particularly as the Mexican election is on July 1st. Right. So
the Mexican election is going to be the way larger impact, because the Mexican election is still completely up in the air, and we have no idea of whether it's going to be an institutional guy or functionally like the Mexican answer to Trump in a wild populist, either from the quasi right or from the far left. So, yeah, all bets are off there. But I can tell you from the American side, I know for a fact that in Trudeau's office, there is a relatively high degree of confidence that if there's going to be a problem, it's not going to come from Congress. And it's thanks in part to the fact that they have lobbied so aggressively, not just, you know, members of Congress and the Senate, but also governors, local politicians, business leaders, NGO leaders, and more importantly, kind of party elders, to make sure that even if there is a massive change in the composition of both houses, that there's not going to be a significant difference in the actual attitudes there. So I just in the last couple of weeks, I got back a couple hundred pages of access to information request documents on the Canadian strategy around NAFTA. And they're quite interesting. They're not revelatory. A lot of it's redacted. Obviously, the government is trying to hold back anything sensitive that could derail negotiations. But the one thing I did get is actually Chrystia Freeland's itinerary for one day of meetings in D.C. And we'll go through all of it, but it's pretty interesting because it is probably one of the most crammed schedules I've ever seen for a minister. She arrived at Dulles in D.C. at 9:55. 11:15, she's meeting with Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. By 12:15, she's meeting with a Republican senator from North Dakota. 1 p.m.
We don't really have to go through her entire Republican day. Yeah.
But we're going to. By 2 p.m., there's another meeting with Secretary Tillerson, 3:30, another Republican, 4:45, a Democrat, 5:30, a group of a dozen or more senators. I mean, you know, we actually have done a pretty great job of figuring out who needs to get talked to.
You don't need to convince me that Freeland's done a good job on this file. I think she's actually one of the shining stars of the Liberal cabinet. Like, and I'm not being sarcastic in any way when I say that. Yeah. I mean, that's been not a great cabinet overall,
but
Freeland's been one of the rare standouts. So, like, I've got no doubt that she's competent. I've got no doubt that she's meeting the right people. I've got no doubt that Canada is doing everything within its power to make this work and make it work to our advantage. But I will go back to this idea that even if we have Congress totally on our side from now up until like November, and they will pass a NAFTA deal, we're still dealing with hard deadlines that even the most supportive Congress in the world can't necessarily fast forward. And as I said, we know that the Congress might be on our side in this particular cycle, but after November, we have got no idea what we're dealing with. We're like the entire chessboard gets reshuffled.
I've talked to people both in D.C. in Ottawa about this. I've asked them that specific question. What they basically said to me is that there's going to be continuity. I mean, it's not as though Nancy Pelosi is going to be taken out on a raft and pushed to sea. I mean, she's still going to be around, right? I mean, any uncertainty at all comes from Trump, not from Congress and the Senate. I mean, both houses have been pretty consistent for the past 20 years that they feel okay about NAFTA. There's been some conversation about tinkering with it, but that's what we're doing. I mean, it's really only a handful of senators on the far left and far right who feel differently.
I think I'm not being clear here. I'm not worried about Congress. That's not really my concern. My concern here is that Trump, in his desperation to score a major victory ahead of the midterms, is going to do something crazy.
Yeah, and that's the danger.
Because there isn't any time to get an actual deal passed by Congress, regardless of whether or not they're good or bad, like that's not relevant, because there's simply no time to do that, that essentially the risk is that Trump will do something crazy, like try to just unilaterally shut down the deal and create some kind of version of zombie NAFTA, which will create enormous trade uncertainty on both sides of the border. Now, I'm not sure that that's going to happen, and I particularly don't think that that's going to happen now that Trump has found himself or sort of finagled himself into some kind of trade war with China. Like, I don't think it benefits the U.S. to be fighting a trade war on two fronts. And I think that, you know, Trump, for all of his conversations about what a great deal breaker and great negotiator he is, has put himself into a bind because he actually doesn't have the leverage from here on in because he doesn't have the cards to get the deal passed before the midterms. And as I said, because of the situation with China, Canada actually has the upper hand hand in a lot of regards, and I think that there's going to be a pressure to put together a fairly non-controversial NAFTA deal that all sides of the borders can more or less agree to, and that a future Congress isn't going to have much incentive to shoot down. That is what I think is the most likely outcome, which is probably the least sexy outcome, which probably means that that is not what's going to happen at all, and that Trump is going to blow it up on Twitter.
It's probably safe to say that Bill Browder is public enemy number one for the Russian government. Browder spent more than a decade working to root out corruption in Russian industry, and for that, he was declared persona non grata. He is the man behind the Magnitsky Act, a legislation you've probably heard of but don't really know all that much about. He spent the better part of the past 8 years trying to convince governments worldwide to adopt the legislation, named for his former lawyer who was tortured and killed in a Russian prison, which would impose sanctions, travel bans, and even asset freezes on corrupt Russian officials and oligarchs. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Great to be here.
So, according to the Russian embassy in Canada, you are a convicted criminal, a fraudster, and a financial bandit.
They forgot to say that they've accused me of being a serial killer, MI6 and CIA spy trying to bring down the Russian Federation, and responsible for the Skripal poisoning. So, I'm surprised they haven't brushed up on their homework.
You've been busy. I mean, it's tough to do that much international intrigue.
And I know your podcast listeners can't see me, but I'm pretty unlikely. I look pretty unlikely to be that international bandit that they make me out to be, but you know, looks can be deceiving.
So, you know, previously the international sanction regime didn't really contemplate stuff like this, right? The sanction regime was a kind of a state-to-state thing. If you were persecuting minorities or if you invaded Kurdistan, sanctions would wind up on your country. We never really tried to go after individual oligarchs or officials or you name it in the past. So do you think that this is a significant change? I mean, to some degree, I think people would say it's symbolic.
Well, it's definitely not symbolic. It's highly efficient. So basically, the way I would describe this is kind of like the new technology for dealing with bad guys around the world. It's very difficult and very imprecise if you sanction a whole country. So if, let's say, no more stuff can be sold to Iran. Well, so the average Iranian who has nothing to do with all the bad stuff is suffering, and the guys at the top are all flying in plane loads of whatever stuff they can't get because of these sanctions. And so what this new law, the Magnitsky Law, does is it turns the whole thing around, which is to say, who's the guys doing the bad stuff? And you sanction them personally, and you sanction them personally by putting them on a sanctions list, by freezing their assets and banning their travel. And everyone else you leave alone. So in Russia, you have a bunch of guys, not that many, maybe 1,000 guys who are completely ruining the country. And then there's a lot of people working for them who are helping ruin the country. But the average Russian is just a victim of this as much as everybody else is. And so what this does is it's like a modern day cancer drug. Instead of almost killing the patient to kill the cancer cell, you just find the cancer cell and wipe it out in a very targeted, direct way. And this is highly effective. And we know this is effective because Putin has told us so. Putin's reaction to the Magnitsky Act was so vehement and so angry and he wasn't playing poker at all. He didn't keep a poker face on this whole thing. First thing he did when the Magnitsky Act was passed in the United States is he banned the adoption of Russian orphans by American families. Now that sounds pretty horrible by itself, but when you dig down into the details, what that really means, the orphans that were being adopted were the sick orphans, the ones with HIV and Down syndrome and other things. And many of these orphans could not be cared for in Russian orphanages. And so they would die in Russian orphanages unless an American family came along and picked them up and took them back, which Americans did on a regular basis. So by banning these adoptions, Putin was effectively sentencing orphan children to death to respond to the Magnitsky Act.
You know, it's interesting because the use of that tactic led the Putin government effectively sort of make this about something different. They didn't want to belay how much they were actually frustrated, angry, being screwed over by the Magnitsky Act. So they made it about adoption. And so, of course, this came up in the U.S. presidential election when the Kremlin-linked lawyer brought this up with Donald Trump Jr.
Well, so, let me back up one step. Putin was explicit about how much he hated the Magnitsky Act. He put together a foreign policy white paper about what he thought was important. And he said repealing the Magnitsky Act is his single largest foreign policy priority. And when they weren't able to stop it from happening and they saw it starting to catch fire and spread to other countries, they then embarked on a massive international campaign to try to stop it from spreading. And part of that campaign was a woman named Natalia Veselnitskaya, who you called her a Kremlin-linked lawyer. She has recently been outed as effectively a Russian agent. There are documents now which basically prove she's a Russian agent. She said Vladimir Putin sent an an agent into Trump Tower to meet with Donald Trump Jr., Paul Manafort, and Jared Kushner. And that she had only one request on behalf of Vladimir Putin, which was to repeal the Magnitsky Act.
So in Canada, you know, there was a time where it almost seemed incredibly unlikely that we would have adopted something like the Magnitsky Act, because Canada had this whole envisionment of basically reestablishing diplomatic ties with Russia. And I think you've been quite critical of the our previous foreign affairs minister, Stéphane Dion, his plan to basically make nice with Putin and become some sort of middle ground between the U.S. and Russia. Can you kind of give me some of the backstory of that? I mean, did you actually have conversations with Stéphane Dion?
Let me back up a couple steps before we get to Stéphane. So I had been working with Erwin Kotler, former Justice Minister of Canada and a member of Parliament at the time, to get a Magnitsky Act in Canada. He was my main partner in this exercise. And we had spent a long time. We started at the same time as we started in the United States, but it took a long time. And then we finally had convinced, at the time, the Conservative government. He was a Liberal MP.
Because they had introduced the bill a couple of times. It just didn't really go anywhere.
We convinced the Conservative government. They were ready to do it. It was all about actually bells and whistles, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's. And then all of a sudden, as it happens, an election was called. And so when the election was called, we then went out to all the different political parties and said, if your party forms a government, will you do a Magnitsky Act? And this was an important thing, mainly because a large part of the Canadian population comes from Ukraine and Poland and Eastern Europe. And this was relevant for them. Those people, we had been in touch with all the major diaspora groups, and they were all fully on board that Canada should have this. And so it became a domestic political issue. And every political party, the Liberals, the Conservatives, and the NDP, all supported the Magnitsky Act in writing. And so then Trudeau and the Liberals won the election, he forms a government, and Stéphane Dion comes in, and he's too afraid to actually say that he doesn't want to do Magnitsky. This is like sort of trying to squash it by stealth. He was like not even a man enough to say we don't want to do it and then try to defend his position. And so there was all this sort of weird passive-aggressive sweeping it under the carpet stuff going on, and it became clearer and clearer that he was absolutely against it. And then people started to break ranks and actually tell us what he was saying behind closed doors, which was that he was absolutely against it. And when we asked why, the only excuse he could give really was that he wanted to go to conferences that Russia was part of. And I thought, so you want to give up being like a moral leader so that you can go to conferences? That's just shocking. And so I wasn't shy at all about basically calling him a craven appeaser of Russia. To this day, I the fact that he's been so disingenuous about not even explaining himself, I still hold ill will towards him. But anyways, the good news is that he was clearly not a good foreign minister in this area. And he was, pretty bad in some other areas because he got sacked.
I'm not sure if you read it, but there's a new book that came out the last couple of weeks. It's in French, but we actually had the author on the podcast about 2 weeks ago. And he kind of gave us the backstory, and more or less that Trudeau was sort of fed up with, amongst other things, Stéphane Dion's insistence of reestablishing relations with Russia. And basically the only one-on-one conversation they had for his entire tenure, almost 2 years, a year and a half, as foreign affairs minister, was about Russia, where Stéphane Dion was insisting again and again, you know, it's time to drop the sanctions, it's time to re-engage the dialogue. And Trudeau basically says, you're fired, would you like a job in Europe? It gets basically shuffled out of the country. So, you know, I think obviously some of that pressure worked.
Well, and the huge prize of his firing was Chrystia Freeland. And she wasn't just a huge prize because she's an amazing person and really good at and knows how to do a lot of things that need to be done. But for me, it was a huge prize because I knew Chrystia. We go back all the way back to when I was starting my campaigns against corruption in Russia. She was at the Financial Times, and she was the only journalist brave enough to run big anti-oligarch stories that I was giving to her. And so it was clear back then, this diminutive person who is larger than life, she was a giant.
Her cameos in your book are fantastic. I wasn't quite anticipating them, and then suddenly Chrystia Freeland's making an appearance.
She was amazing. She was amazing. And the moment I met her, I knew that this was a person that was going to do amazing things far and beyond the Financial Times. And so she did. She helped me expose a bunch of oligarchs, which was a brave thing to do back then. And reporters had been killed for doing that kind of stuff. And then she eventually found her way to Reuters and then to Parliament. And she was one of the big supporters of the Magnitsky Act in Parliament. I think she was the one who drafted the Liberal Party's commitment to a Magnitsky Act. And then all of a sudden, when Stéphane Dion gets fired for being either like ineffective, incompetent, or appeasers, or whatever the reasons were, she comes in. And it took a total of 2 weeks for her to turn everything around. And it's really only because of her that we were able to to get to write this and send our campaign in the right direction so we could actually get the Magnitsky Act passed. And we got it passed.
And she's been a frequent target of, you know, Russian disinformation, Russian propaganda, Russian criticism. You know, the Russian embassy in Canada has spent an ungodly amount of time going after her. So maybe you could talk a bit just about, you know, how the Russian government tried to stem the tide of this act spreading further. Because I think it's, you know, it's fair to say it was one of the, like you said, one of their top foreign policy priorities. I mean, they pulled out a lot of stuff. There was an Interpol red notice against you. It was repeated recently.
Yeah, well, so first of all, the way that they do these things is they try to target anybody who they think is a leader of the whole initiative. They try to make personal consequences for anybody. And so they went on this big campaign against Chrystia with all sorts of complete nonsense about her grandfather, about calling her, they do this whole, anybody who's Ukrainian must be a Nazi and a fascist. And they tried to like paint her as a Nazi and fascist and all this kind of stuff.
I've talked about this a bit on the show before, but I was getting messages from the Russian embassy with exactly all this information, you know, well before this all became public.
They weren't even trying to hide it. There's also my main activist partner in Canada is a guy named Marcus Kolga. And Natalia Veselnitskaya publicly called for an investigation, a criminal investigation in Moscow into Marcus Kolga, who probably hasn't set foot in Russia ever. And they're going around, you know, poking at us and finding also, so that those are the sort of most explicit things. But then they were also poking around with these agents of influence. And so there's a bunch of think tank people and academics who are writing op-eds in the Globe and Mail and other newspapers saying that, you know, this is going to lead to a third world war and all this kind of stuff. And I would say it was a highly ineffective counter campaign. There's not a whole lot of people that really bought into it. They did have this one group. It was called I can't remember the name of it. Some kind of Russian diaspora group.
These guys were great.
And what's that?
These guys were great. I mean, they barely existed before they suddenly cropped out of nowhere to campaign against the Magnitsky Act.
Right. And they wrote all these letters to all these members of parliament saying, you know, you don't understand that we don't support this and we don't support you if you support this and so on and so forth. And again, none of this stuff worked. And it was really, in a certain way, it's almost gratifying to watch them stumbling so much.
You know, I think this is interesting because, you know, we all give all this credit to Russia for being this incredibly cunning, you know, foreign power that is capable of, you know, untold things. But most of their actions are pretty clunky. I mean, you know, they've tried to use the Interpol system to go after you. They've tried and failed, I think, to influence politics, at least maybe outside the U.S., on a more global level. Well, it hasn't worked especially well. There's been a couple of exceptions, of course. But even when they, you know, try to clandestinely kill someone with, you know, a nerve agent, they get ID'd immediately, and they didn't even succeed in killing the guy.
Well, so this is a very important observation, which you present very accurately. Most people don't. That they're not this all-powerful country. What they do is they'll initiate like 100 different operations with the full expectation that 99 of them will fail badly, fail humiliatingly, wasting millions and millions of dollars on the hopes that just one of them succeeds. And the reason that they're able to do that is, like, unlike any other Western democracy, there's no accountability for how they spend their money. And so it just doesn't matter. They can just waste and waste and waste money doing all this stuff, doing it very, very stupidly. But their objective is just to somehow slip through the cracks where somebody's not paying attention and have one of these things succeed. And I would go beyond that. So if you look at Russia very objectively, this is a country with an economy the size of New York State. Okay, this is a country with a military which is 5% of the budget of the U.S. military. They're not an international superpower. They've got two things going for them to put them on the world stage. One is that they got more nuclear warheads than anybody. But the second thing is that they're effectively an international mafia organization just going around making trouble wherever they can. And that trouble is more visible than anything else out there. It's like ISIS. You know, ISIS was going around making trouble. It's just a bunch of ragtag guys, you know, holding up trucks and kidnapping people to fund their operations.
But nevertheless, you know, Russia has managed to convince a handful of international players that there really is kind of a Russia versus the West divide, and they can convince some to join the Russia side. I mean, right now, and I know this is something you've been advocating for recently, there's a family by the name of the Mikhov family who are, you know, being jailed in Guatemala because seemingly the Guatemalan government has taken the side of Putin. And basically, I think the charges against them are not dissimilar to the charges that you faced.
Yeah, so the story in the Bitkov family is really something that has just gotten me so enraged. This is a story, a Russian family that were a victim of a corporate raid in Russia, which is the same type of thing that happened to me. They stole their business, and more shockingly, at the time, they had a 16-year-old daughter named Anastasia who was kidnapped for 3 days, drugged and repeatedly raped by the corporate raiders. And then after they were, their daughter was completely psychologically destroyed after all their money was stolen from the government, they were told that they would be killed if they stayed in Russia. And so they fled. And first they went to Latvia, then they went to Turkey, and then they chose Guatemala, thinking that they could just disappear into the other side of the world. And they took the little money they had left, which was and they employed a Guatemalan law firm to apply for all the passport documents and so on. They eventually get to Guatemala, get passports. They learn Spanish. The father becomes a high school math teacher. The mother becomes a drawing teacher at the same school. The daughter is finally sort of starting to normalize and recover from her horrific ordeal. They have one more child when they're in Guatemala. 5 years later, the Russian government tracks them down. And the Russian government tracks them down. They hire the most expensive, prestigious lawyer in Guatemala, who is also a Supreme Court judge. He was running a law firm and being a judge at the same time. He's like totally connected inside the Guatemalan legal system. His name is Henry Comte. And then between the Russian bank that was running this operation, Henry Comte, they then convince a UN anti-corruption organization, which was paid for by the Canadian government, the U.S. government, and the EU. They convince this organization, it's called CSEG, which is supposed to fight impunity in Guatemala, and they convince them to prosecute this family for passport violations. And in the process, then the Russians show up and try to take the three-year-old child. So they arrest the family. They stick them in pretrial detention. They take this child, and the Russians try to take the child back to Russia to stick him in an orphanage. And thank God the child was only a Guatemalan citizen, so they couldn't legally do that. Then the Russians convince the prosecutor to stick the child in a Guatemalan orphanage, even though the family's lawyer was ready to take the child. He spends 42 days in the orphanage while they're making desperate appeals. He comes out completely physically abused out of the orphanage. The family is sitting in pretrial detention, and eventually the case goes to court. And at the urging and at the insistence of this UN anti-corruption organization, they sentence the father to 19 years in prison and the mother and daughter to 14 years in prison for passport violations. And so, I mean, this is like a totally perfect example of how Russia is able to, and I don't think it's the Guatemalan government that's doing this. I think that they found individuals inside all these organizations that they paid money to. And there's a lot of very vicious rumors going around about who got paid in this whole story. And the message of this story, and it's just so heartbreaking, and the message for these Russians in Russia, why are they chasing this family, is so next time they go around to somebody and say, hand over your business, and the person says no, they say, well, if you say no, you know, look what happened to the Bitkovs.
So, you know, what's at the tail end of all of this? You know, obviously the Magnitsky Act has started actually sort of hitting these officials and you know, the people carrying out Putin's agenda where it hurts. And obviously the Putin government is starting to feel the pain, both from this and from the generalized state sanctions. But it doesn't seem clear to anyone I've spoken to that, you know, that Putin's era is coming to an end, or that there's a particular appetite for change. Obviously there will be a crisis point eventually if the sanctions continue. But, you know, does something else need to give in order for either the Putin administration to kind of stop its international aspirations or for the government to change?
Well, I don't think it's our place to try to change the Russian government. I think they have to the Russians have to change their own government. It's our place to contain them so that they don't do any of this nasty stuff going forward. And I would argue that very recently the sanctions, the oligarch sanctions, have done exactly that, which is to contain Putin. So these oligarch sanctions, these seven richest oligarch tycoons who are sanctioned, that's Putin's money, or some of it's Putin's money. And you can see by everything that Putin has done since then that it's like in a boxing match. He got smacked right in the face. He's now seeing double. He's like wobbly. He doesn't know what to do. If he retaliates, then there's like seven more oligarchs we're going to sanction. The way you deal with Putin to stop all this stuff is to create hard consequences for any bad actions. And he won't test people who create hard consequences. He laughs at appeasement, and he might grumble at consequences, but he's not going to do stuff where there's consequences. So, remember, this is an economy the size of the state of New York. He'll start picking on people that we don't care about. You know, all we can do is contain him, and containment means devastating financial sanctions when they do all this election manipulation, Magnitsky sanctions against a lot of regime officials who are doing human rights violations. It means fully supporting NATO and NATO allies in Eastern Europe with enough firepower so that Putin understands that, you know, he'll rue the day that he ever thought about doing anything in that part of the world. And things like when in Syria, if his allies start doing bad stuff, we go in and we hit them hard. That's what Putin responds to. He doesn't respond to anything less than that.
Well, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
That was Oppo. I'm glad you learned about the shit woman take online, Justin.
I mean, I learned that David Suzuki is persona non grata in Alberta.
That was not a surprise. In fact, that's not actually very surprising at all. We want to know what you think. Email us at oppo@canadalandshow.com. You can find us on Twitter at oppocast.
And we have a very special end of the show because we've broken the 200 review mark on iTunes. So we're going to share with you some of the very wonderful feedback we've gotten. And we have not actually read these yet, so I'm very excited to break into the old mailbag of the iTunes review catalog and find out how much we suck.
My favorite one is titled, "Why Read Postmedia When You Can Listen to This?" 1 star, by LeninLover420. Really excellent surface-level analysis with opinions you can hear from your dad.
The next one comes from Just Terrible, by Jan Basque. Great name, Jan. A podcast that nobody asked for and nobody needs, can't understand why it exists. Canadaland could spend its crowdfunded money, I'm a regular patron, thanks, on better projects.
Dumpster Fire, 1 star, by Johnny Canuck and the Quantum Cowboys. Who thought these presenters were a good idea? Self-indulgent, silly, and stupid. In an effort to be amusing and cool, the hosts feel the need to be shallow and silly and vulgar.
Fuck.
Sure, we are fucking vulgar. Apparently, they've been overly influenced by American-style news and opinion programs. Please, grow up. Do your parents know you talk like this? Actually, they do. They do.
Hi, Mom.
I said, I actually want to do a version of this podcast with my gun-loving dad. I've actually run it by him. And when Justin wants to take a break, we're absolutely going to do this. I'm really excited.
So please, everyone, go onto iTunes and leave us a review. And please make it as colorful and wonderful as the ones we've just read. And you might hear it on the air next week.
Tankies, I think you can do better than this.
You and your tankies, Jen.
Oh, I love the tankies. Leninlover420, you're my person. The next episode of Oppo will be out in 2 weeks, Canada Land's original deep dive politics show for those of you who aren't looking for stuff that's shallow, silly, and vulgar. That show's called Commons, and it will be out next week.
This episode was produced by David Crosby for Canada Land Media. Our managing editor is Kevin Sexton, and music by Nathan Burley.
I have the last word this week, and that word is quantum.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, I thought it would be good.
Hey, it's Matea, reminding you that this show cannot be made without you. If you've been thinking about becoming a Canada Land supporter, we're having a pretty great sale right now. You'll get premium ad-free feeds of all Canada Land shows, discounts on merch from our store, and exclusive bonus episodes, like a behind-the-scenes tour of the federal budget lockup, more of Boris Johnson's trip to Canada, and of course, more of us yapping about what's hot in politics right now. We want to make it as easy as possible for you to become a Canada Land supporter. So from now until the end of May, we have a special offer for our listeners. Sign up now for just $2 a month for the next 6 months. Just go to canadaland.com/join or click the link in your show notes to become a supporter today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
Well, something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in...
opinions.
We do that in every episode, too.
We're professional unprofessional, so if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.